This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. Welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. For this holiday weekend, we're featuring highlights from Jim Poplava's Investment Strategy Conference, which took place on October 21st of this year. The charts and visuals referred to on this program can be found with the program description on the website at financialsense.com. Next up for the Financial Sense Investment Strategy Conference will be Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. In this hour, I'm going to be talking about the high current valuations that we're seeing, not just in the stock market, but in all markets. And because of the high valuations, why we want to be looking at active management versus passive management. So the secret to investment success, a lot of us have heard this. Buy low, sell high. In reality, this is what we do. At the tops, we're greedy, so we buy. In the bottoms, we jump out of the window and we sell. We repeat that until we're broke. I want to focus on how do you know when to buy low and how do you know when to sell high. And that's principally what I'm going to be talking about is valuations. As Warren Buffett said, price is what you pay, value is what you get. And what as I was mentioning before, we typically sell at bottoms and we buy at tops. And I want to go look at this historically. This is from 1965 to 1992. And in the 70s, we had high inflation, we had several recessions, and so the stock market essentially went nowhere. And in about 1980, 81, Business Week had an article out, and the cover said the death of equities. And that was just before the greatest bull market in history in the U.S. So there's fear. Let me show you some greed. This is after the tech bubble. This is the Dow Jones from 1990 to 2000, and it was around 11,000. There was books out, Dow 40,000, Dow 36,000. Everyone was trying to one-up each other, and we saw what happened. And it's not just with the stock market where this happens. This was June 2005, Home Sweet Home, Time Magazine cover. That right there is June 2005. What this ratio is it's looking at the median price of a home relative to the median income. As your income goes up, you should be able to afford a home. As your income goes down, the price of a home that you could buy should be going down in terms of what you can budget. This goes all the way back to 1975. Look at the bubble. And this is what the sentiment was by the populace. Home sweet home. So again, how do you know when to buy and when to sell? The whole issue is valuation. Again, as Warren Buffett said, price is what you pay. The price of the home you bought in 2005 or 2004, that's what you paid. Value is what you ended up getting. And valuations are interesting. As Benjamin Graham, the father of investing, said, in the short run, the market is a voting machine. It's based on sentiment. But in the long run, it's a weighing machine. There's measurements to tell on valuations of what you're buying and what you're selling. Let me explain this graph. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and I actually don't want it to, and that's the point. What we're looking at right here is PE levels, going from a low PE of 8 to 23. And on the left is the forward return looking out 1 year. So right here is where we are currently in terms of our valuation. And you can see that your future return might be as high as 40% or as low as 20%. There's a lot of noise here. And again, valuations do not tell you anything about the near future, looking out 1 year or so. And that's very relevant. There's relatively no relationship here. Now let's look out a little bit further. We're not looking out 1 year. Now we're looking out 5 years. Current valuation relative to what the next year's return is. And you can see the relationship is tighter. But again, this is only 5 years. The further you look out, 10 years, 15 years, valuation has a lot more future prediction of returns. And here's another ratio I'm looking at. This is the market cap of equities, the value of equities relative to the economy. And on the left is a future return over the next 10 years. Look how tight that relationship is. And my point is valuations, again, will not tell you anything about the near future. It's the longer future where you have more predictive power based on where things are currently. And what our firm looks at a little bit differently than the average RIA shop is we look at returns, not looking back 100 years. And that's what most people do. You go into a financial advisor, they look at how stocks have returned for the last 100 years, which is about 6.5%, and they assume that's going to happen. Let me tell you why that's dangerous, because no one in this room has a lifespan of 100 years. Look at what happened, and what we're looking at right here is the S&P going back to 1870 to the present. And what we're looking at is the 20-year annualized returns from the starting point. So here's the S&P, and in red was the future returns annualized for 20 years. If you bought in 1900, your future returns going out to 1920 was a loss of 0.6%. You earned nothing for 20 years. What happened if you bought in 1920 and you looked out to 1940? You earned almost 10% annualized every year for 20 years. Now let's look at 1929, just before the Great Depression. Going from 1929 to 1949, you made a little less than 0.5% for 20 years. Another example, if you would have bought just after World War II, mid-1940s to mid-1960s, you earned 13.3% every year annualized. Another example, the mid-60s, or about 1960, you purchased and you retired, you put all of your money in the stock market. Going out to 1980, again, 0.5%. The whole point of when you buy matters. Buy low, sell high. What happens if you're in the stock market at a high point? High valuation. You should expect low future returns. Here was buying in 1980 and the year 2000 with the tech bubble, you earned 13.6%. Looking at the year 2000, we don't have 20 years of data yet, but we're likely to have a period of, again, really subpar returns. So my point is, in the retirees, they think of years of 20 years or 30 years in retirement. No one should be thinking of years of 100 years. And that's what most financial planners and advisors do. They look backwards and they assume the past is going to be the present. What I want to talk about next is how high are we currently? And again, I'm quoting a lot of Warren Buffett because he is a value investor. He said, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. Again, buy low when everyone else is fearful, sell high when everyone else is high-fiving each other. One of his favorite valuation indicators was looking at the market cap of U.S. equities relative to the economy. This goes back to 1950 all the way to the present. This was the tech bubble of 2000. This was 1980. And again, remember when I said 1980? From 1980 to 1920, the S&P annualized about 13.5%. Look at how low the market cap was of U.S. equities relative to the economy. Here's 2000. Here's 2007. This is 2009. Here's where we are presently. The only time we've been higher looking at this indicator was the year 2000. From our vantage point, the stock market is elevated. Here's another way to look at that. What I'm looking at in black is the S&P 500 going from World War II all the way to the present. And in red, I'm looking at the value of household equities, all the equities we collectively own relative to the size of the economy. This was 1968. I believe that was the year we put a man on the moon. And then you look back at 1980, this was the low. Here's 2000, 2007. Presently, we have never been higher. We exceed the level we saw in the year 2000. Another valuation indicator I look at is looking at four different valuation tools and looking at what the average valuation is compared to history. This goes back to 1900 all the way to the present. This was a 1929 peak in valuation just before the Great Depression. This was the mid-60s. Here's 2000. Here we are presently. Presently, right now, looking at an average of four different valuation indicators, we are 100% above our long-term average. The average is this red line. What does that mean? The market would have to lose half of its value just to return to average valuations. And to have an average, usually you go above and below. Rarely do you stop on the average. 2009, we actually fell 13% below the average. So when you think of valuations right now, think of risk. The higher you're buying, the higher, more expensive something is that you're buying, the more risk you have to a downturn. This is from Goldman Sachs' chief investment officer. And don't get carried away a little bit on what these details are, but essentially what he is doing, he's looking at various valuation metrics. I think he was looking at 10 different ones. And what he wanted to look at, it was percentiles. Where are we, and what is the average valuation of all these different ways to look at the market? And what he came up with was that we are in the 87th percentile looking at multiple ways of how to value the stock market. So it's not just our view, it's even Goldman Sachs' view that we are elevated. Now, as I mentioned to you, you don't want to do what everyone else is doing. When they're jumping out the window, you want to be buying. The secret to investment success, don't follow the herd. This is a really interesting way to look at it, and it's essentially how to do the opposite of what everyone else is doing. What I'm looking at on this top panel, and there's a lot here, so let me walk you through it. The top panel is S&P 500 in black, going to 1950 to the present. And what we're looking at is the amount of looking at households and your financial assets. How much do you have in stocks? How much do you have in bonds? How much do you have in homeowners' equity and real estate? And what we found was that in 2000, going back all the way to 1950, U.S. households had never owned so much of their total financial assets in the stock market. That was clearly a bubble. Looking in 2009, everyone panicked. You sold your stock portfolio and you jumped into the bond market at the worst possible time in March of 2009. Look at the amount of bond ownership in the average U.S. household going all the way back to 1950. Never been higher. Again, the worst possible move is selling at a bottom and going into safety assets, which was at the wrong time because of valuation. Look at equity and real estate as a percent of your total financial assets. Here was 2005 at the housing bubble. Here was 2000. Here was 1980. And if you remember, housing for the most part in the U.S. bottomed around 2010, 2011. Look at where how much equity we had in real estate. Housing was a phenomenal purchase in 2010, 2011. Look at the how much little we had in equity. That was the lowest level we have ever seen. Even currently right now, we have less in housing than we did even at the low we saw in 2000. So if you're just looking at this, where does everyone have their cash collectively? We have our financial assets in the stock market. This is the present. That's 2007. Here's 2000. Collectively, we have the most money in equities and at the highest point almost since 2000, very little in bonds. And we have a fair amount in homeowners' equity. So again, what would you want to do? Here's the easiest way to get rich. Look for the extremes and do the opposite of everyone else. Sell stocks, buy stocks. Buy bonds, sell bonds. Sell real estate, buy real estate. Looking at this right now, what does everyone think you should be doing? Selling stocks, buying bonds. And that is partly why you can see in your portfolios, we've been slowly shifting out of the stock market. We want to do the opposite of what everyone else is doing. What do high current valuations tell us about the future? Remember I said valuations tell you very little about the near future, but when you look out on a longer horizon, they can tell you a great deal. This is looking again at market cap of U.S. equities relative to GDP and how that's done a good job of predicting returns looking out 10 years. Here we are currently, and what that is predicting is low single-digit returns for the stock market looking 10 years from now. So we're talking now to 2027. We should expect, based on this relationship, if it follows the historical precedent, very low returns in our stock portfolios. Here's another way of looking at it. This is coming from Recession Alert. He's looking at, in blue, is the S&P from 1970 to the present. And what he is looking at, his forecast is in green, and that's looking at what is the annual return expected for the next 10 years. In black was the actual return. You can notice how his model has done a pretty good job of predicting where things are. This was the 2000 peak in equities. Look at what his returns were saying. Low returns. And that's exactly what we saw. Here was buying stocks in the March 2009 bottom. You should have returns looking out 10 years of around 325%. This isn't annualized. What does it say right now with where we are currently? It's looking at a lower forecast than even buying stocks in the year 2000. A very dismal future looking out 10 years. Here's another company. It's Butler, Philbrick, and Gordella Associates. And they had a lot of inputs. I don't want to bore you with the details. But they've come up with a model that's done a really good job of predicting future returns. And do you remember when I went to that example of buying in 20-year increments, 1920 or 1929, and what your future 20-year returns are? They did the same thing with their model. Key year, 1929, just before the Great Depression, their model predicted annual returns for 15 years of negative 1.27. Here was the actual. June 1942, great buying opportunity. They predicted 13%, actual is 14.5%. So you can see it can go from high to low depending on what value you're buying in the market. And again, here's what I want you to focus on. Most financial planners and RIAs look at this, the long-term average. Look at how different the long-term average can be. It can be well below or well above. You should not be looking backwards to look forwards. What does it say currently? And this is data as of 2014. What they are predicting from 2014 to 2029, we should see returns of negative 2% annualized. Looking 20 years, negative returns, 15, 10, or even 5 years. A very dismal outlook. Another way of looking at things, again, is what households are doing. And this has actually been a pretty good predictor of future returns. Household equity ownership of their total financial assets. And this is looking at a 10-year forecast. The forecast is in red, and the actual trailing 10-year return is in blue. This, again, was buying in the year 2007 top. And here's where we are presently. Based on where we are, we should be expecting, this says about 3% return. Not negative like the last one, but still very low returns compared to the historical average. And what he did is he looked at this prediction, and he based on where current price is for the S&P and what that path would look like. This is 2006. This is out to 2026. In green is the actual S&P, and in blue is the predicted model. And what it's saying is that we should be seeing a very sideways market into the mid-20s. And that's how we can get really low returns overall. But here's where we are currently. We're above where we should be based on this relationship. You might be hard for you to believe, again, that this can happen, where you can have a long period of low returns, but this has happened before. And what I'm looking at in black is the S&P divided by the CPI index. So I mean, this is inflation-adjusted stock returns. 1968 to 1992, 24 years, when you back out inflation, you made nothing. Just looking at the appreciation, obviously there was dividends, but outside of income, you went absolutely nowhere for 24 years. From August 2000 to February 2015, 15 years, no real appreciation in the stock market. This can happen, and why looking at value matters so much more than the noise you read in here in the television. Another group, and unfortunately, it's not just the stock market that's expensive currently. There's other assets. GMO, this is by Jeremy Grantham's organization. He's a huge value investor. He called the 2000 top, he called the 2007 top in housing and equities. And what his firm looks at is looking out 7 years. That's their forecasted model. Looking at stocks, he's predicting negative 7-year returns for large cap U.S. equities, 4% loss. U.S. small cap, 2.5% loss. High quality U.S. stocks, a little less than 1% loss. International, negative returns going out 7 years. International small cap equities, negative returns. The only positive return in the stock market, looking globally, that they are predicting is in emerging markets at 2.6%. Think of how much risk you have to take to get that little bit of return. Emerging markets have a lot of volatility. There's a lot more crises in emerging markets versus developed markets. But that's the best you can look at, according to this firm. 2.6% and one of the riskiest equities of the entire global picture. Looking at bonds, you can't find really anything outside of emerging debt, any positive returns after inflation, looking out 7 years. U.S. bonds, international hedged bonds, emerging market debt, U.S. inflation-linked bonds, and cash. This is a very dismal picture. And again, I wanted to show you, it's not just one firm. There's a lot of firms that look at valuation, and they're all saying the same message. And this is why it's important. This is Research Affiliates, and they're looking at a lot of different asset classes, and they're looking at 10 years. Looking at stocks, U.S., international, emerging markets, the expected nominal after inflation. They do expect good returns, a little bit more optimistic than GMO for emerging markets. But again, they're looking at 10 years versus 7, so not complete apples to apples. But look at U.S. equities, the S&P 500. What is their prediction for 10 years from now? 0.5% return after inflation. Looking at small cap equities, 0.4%. Looking at international, about 4.8. Now looking at the bond market, U.S. treasuries, emerging market debt, corporate debt, and high yield debt, we're looking at very low returns. Cash, negative returns after you factor inflation, which means that inflation is likely to be higher than short-term interest rates. Commodities, positive return. Real estate, low. Where can you find anywhere on this whole spectrum of all the places you can park your money that has really excitable returns? Not a lot. What I did is that same table, and I just sorted it by expected return. Again, negative returns in U.S. long-term treasuries, negative returns in U.S. cash, negative returns in short-term debt. Very dismal picture. Where do you get your returns in some of the riskiest areas of the entire financial market? Emerging market debt, emerging market equities. How do we combat this dismal future? Let me tell you the bright side of this. Looking at where things are, and Jim will go into this a little bit more later in the presentation. Look at all the money from March of 2009 to the present going in passively managed funds. Look at all the money coming out of actively managed funds. Remember what I said, the secret to success? Don't follow the herd. Where is the herd going? Into passive management. Just dump your money in ETFs and set it and forget it. And as I've showed you, that is the worst thing you can do in a period of high valuations. Our belief is that active management is going to come back. And I like some of these quotes by Thomas Edison. We often miss opportunity because it's dressed in overalls and it looks like work. Winston Churchill, a pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. And Milton Berle, if opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. Essentially, what I'm saying, for the next 10 years, 15 years, it's going to take work to grow your financial assets, whether it's in real estate, bonds, or equities. It's going to take work. How do we combat this dismal future of buy and hold? There's a time to be active, and that's when you're rowing, and there's a time to sail, when you let the market carry you. Remember buying in the year 1980 for 20 years, the S&P averaged 13.5%? That's the time to sail. You're buying extremely low, put your money, you have a great buying opportunity, and let it ride. What happens if you're buying in 2000 or buying in 2007? That's the time it's going to take some work. You have to be active. And I want to show you that active or passive, people say that really active is gone, it's dead. Well, that's not true. There's times that where passive beats active, and there's times where active managers typically beat passive managers. Here's what we have in presently. For the last few years, the worst thing you could be is active, because the market has just gone straight up. You sell a company, and it's more than likely to be up in the next year or so. Our belief is that active is going to start to outperform again. And let me show you, again, why there's opportunity in a dismal future, like what we see in the next 10 to 15 years. This is looking at 1928 to 1955. And remember I showed you from the high to the low, from 1929 all the way out post-World War II, the Dow went absolutely nowhere. But look at the opportunity. If you're active, you're not buy and hold. The Dow fell 89% into 1932. It rallied 371% by 1936. It fell 52% by 1942. And from 42 to 46, 127% gain. We had a 23% loss after World War II ended, and we had to rebuild our economy from a war economy to a service-based economy, manufacturing. And from 1949 all the way to the point where we exceeded the last peak in 1929, the market rose 134%. Look at these huge moves that are possible if you get out of the way, you get back in. Again, buy low, sell high. Buy low, sell high. And what I want to show you is that active management does not require perfect timing to add value. This is an interesting study that Ryan Price in our office did. And what he looked at was how valuable can being active be? Essentially, what he's looking at is how late can you be or imperfect and still add value? Remember when we were looking at returns long-term last 100 years? You're looking around 6.5 to 6.9%. That's buy and hold. Here's what happens when you're 1 month late of getting out. And once the bull market begins, you're 1 month late getting in. Your annual returns were 16.5%. And that's being late, missing the top. Look at what happens if you get out of a bull market top 6 months late and you get into a new bull market 6 months late. You still have nearly or almost double the return of a passive investor. You do not have to be perfect market timer to still add value. And the whole point of this is the idea of large losses. If your portfolio falls 10%, it needs to rally 11% to break even. What happens if you lose half your money? You have to double your return just to break even. The question is, if active management is important, when is it most useful? This is the S&P going from 1929 to the present. These red lines, those are recessions. When are most of the declines historically in the stock market? They typically happen around recessions. And that's why monitoring the business cycle is so important to risk management and knowing when to buy and when to sell. So the question is, what inning are we in? Dave Rosenberg, who's an economist that I really respect, he writes a wonderful publication called Breakfast with Dave. If you can afford it, I'd highly recommend it. And what he was looking at was 14 to 15 variables economically. It's kind of what Goldman Sachs did looking at valuations. He's using many variables looking at the business cycle. And he's looking at from the low to the high, how much have we recovered from what the average is? You can see that 89% of all these variables, we've already exceeded that level. And according to Dave Rosenberg, we've got about one inning left. In his opinion, one more year in terms of the lifespan of this economy. There's a couple of ones that we track. And the reason why I track them is often there's certain indicators that give you a good warning, sometimes years before the business cycle ends. One of them is corporate profits relative to GDP. In red is recessions. Look at corporate profits. Peak recession. Peak recession. Peak recession. They give you a good early warning that you are past the halfway point. This was 2015. Look at where we are right now. We're already on the downslope. And again, this is in our opinion why the best for the U.S. economy is behind us. We're starting that slow descent towards the next recession. Another one is looking at auto sales. They peaked in November of 2015. Again, the red lines are recessions. This goes from 1976 to the present. This was the 2000 recession. You could see the peak happened before that. 2007 recession, the peak came well before that. Look at what we're seeing right now. Auto sales have peaked, and they are already heading down. And looking at where we are, in terms of not just certain early warnings, it's another one is looking at what central bankers are doing. What the Fed does is near the end of the business cycle, the Fed is starting to raise interest rates as the economy is starting to pick up momentum, and it's trying to slow it down. So in the first half of the business cycle, the Fed is your friend. Interest rates are low, the Fed is possibly cutting. In the latter half of a business cycle, the Fed is in front of you. The Fed is trying to put the brakes on. And Ray Dalio, he's the founder of the world's largest hedge fund. He said, central bankers try to tighten at paces that are exactly right in order to keep growth and inflation neither too hot nor too cold until they don't get it right. At that point, we have our next downturn. Recognizing that, our responsibility now is to keep dancing, but closer to the exit. And that's exactly what we're doing as a firm. And again, this is a slide that I believe Jim showed earlier. This is looking at past financial crises and the Fed funds rate, going from 1971 to the present. You can see every time the Fed raises rates, there's someone who's too leveraged, whether it's a bank, whether it's corporations or the consumer, and there's a panic, there's a crisis. We had the tech bubble, the 07 subprime bubble bursting, and we're starting to raise interest rates again. Who's going to be the next shoe to fall? We don't know as of right now. Usually you see that in hindsight. We have seen 13 Fed hike cycles since World War II. 9 out of those 13 landed in recession. Very rarely does the Fed raise rates and not cause a recession. Very rarely. We saw that in 1965. We saw that in the mid-80s and again in the mid-80s. And then in the mid-90s, the last two times the Fed raised rates, we saw a recession. The Fed started in December of 2015, was the first rate hike this cycle. When does the Fed funds rate become too hot? And this is another slide that Jim showed earlier. And this is looking at the Fed funds rate going from 1980 to the present. And you can see that every cycle has seen a lower rate in the Fed funds rate before the next recession. And there's a very clear trend in this pattern. And our prediction is if the Fed continues on its predicted path of raising a few more times in December of this year and a couple more times next year, we could be pushing that upper bound. The question is, why does it take a lower level of interest rates to cause a recession? As Jim showed in hour one, more debt. The more debt you have, the more costly it is when rates rise. And we saw that with the federal government. The federal government's doubled its balance sheet and it's not paying as much interest rates as it did in 2008. What's going to happen if the interest rates keep moving up for the federal government? homeowners, and corporations. This is looking at the Federal Reserve's tightening cycles and kind of looking at what lead time do we have when the Fed starts raising interest rates and when the next recession occurs. In the 70s and early 80s, we saw a secular trend in rising interest rates, and the Fed often was behind the curve in terms of inflation. And what we're looking at is the starting rate, the ending rate, what the total increase was, and the last increase, how many more months before the next recession began. And we saw that the Fed raised a ton, and it was a very short warning before we slipped into recession. Since 1980, we've been in a declining trend of interest rates, and we've seen that it takes a less of a move in interest rates, and we have a longer lead time. Overall, the average has been 6.73 in terms of how much the Fed raises rates before we slip into a recession. And in the last few cycles where interest rates have been falling, the average has been 3.88. If the Fed raises like we believe and the market does in December of this year, the Fed will have increased 4.5%. And I say that because the low we're looking at is -3. What the Atlanta Fed did is they said, okay, the interest rates were at zero, but the Fed was printing money. When we look at how much money the Fed printed, if that was expressed as an interest rate, where would have interest rates have been? And what they found, based on their research, was that how much money the Fed printed with QE1, QE2, and QE3, interest rates got down to -3%. And interestingly, that was right on the lower trend that we've seen going back three decades. And so that's how I get the 4.5% increase, starting from a low of 3% and an estimated high of 1.5% by this December. So you can see at 4.5%, we are already past the amount of raising that the Fed has done in the prior cycles. What we're looking at is a window of vulnerability. And as I showed before, corporate profit margins and auto sales peak before the recession begins. And what I looked at, and Ryan Price assisted with this, was looking at when we look at the beginning of a cycle and the end of a cycle, where did that occur where corporate profit margins peaked and auto sales peaked? And what we found was that profits peaked about just past the halfway point of the cycle. Autos were about two-thirds of the way. And in terms of the baseball and innings, profits peaked in the sixth inning, autos peaked in the middle of the seventh inning. So looking at that, we know that corporate profit margins have peaked. We know that auto sales have peaked. And we know when this expansion began, in June of 2009. Knowing those two points, we can forecast where the ending point might be for this current expansion. And what we have, and what we're looking at, is between March 2019 to August 2019 is a window of vulnerability for the U.S. economy. And again, things can change with Trump next year. If we have some tax reform, fiscal stimulus, things can get extended out a little bit. But interestingly, if you look at going back 100 years, typically the stock market predicts a recession 6 to 9 months in advance. So if we're looking at a possible recession window between March 2019 and August 2019, looking at 6 to 9 months before that, we could be looking at a bull market top as early as the summer of next year or as late as early 2019. Again, we're in the latter innings here, and there's a lot more risk given where valuations are. How much more upside is there? Barry Bannister is an economist and a strategist I really respect. He looked at, and this was an interesting study, he looked back going all the way to post-World War II, we've had 11 business cycles. And what he wanted to look at right here is day zero. This is the point the recession begins. And he wanted to look at what did the Dow Jones do leading into a recession? What was the average path? And he went back 500 days before the recession began, and this was the point of the recession began. And you can see about 1 year before a recession begins, there's very little upside in the stock market. The stock market is beginning to see, or investors are beginning to predict, that earnings are likely to slow. The economy is likely to slow. So the momentum in the stock market begins to stall. If he's correct that, in his belief, the recession begins December of 2018, this is the current stock market. How much more upside is there? Possibly 2 or 3% if we follow the normal historical script. And rarely do we. We usually go above or a little bit below. But again, the point is, if we're correct that late 2018, early 2019 might be the window where we slip into the next recession, there's likely less upside in the stock market. Knowing that, the investment playbook should be defense wins championships. Again, when do you know when to take your money off the table and when do you put your chips back on? Here's an interesting question I have for everyone. Looking at the last 14 major market tops, and we're looking at when the Dow Jones Industrial Average peaked, how many people would estimate what the percentage of stocks that are in the market in the New York Stock Exchange put in their high on the same day the market did? So the day, think of October of 2007 when the Dow peaked. What percentage of stocks would you think were hitting also their all-time high? 1%, 5%, 10%, or more than 20%? Anyone want to make a guess?
1%.
Let's look at it a little bit differently. What the actual answer was 6.4%. There are thousands of stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. Thousands. And the day the Dow peaks, on average, going back to the Great Depression, 6.3%. The market gets more and more selective. Because fewer stocks are participating in the bull market, that's why you see the market tend to start to stall out before recession begins. In October 9, 2007, roughly 11% of the market was also hitting a new high. At the 2000 peak, 3.5% of stocks were also hitting a new high. Being a stock picker was very difficult near market tops. What's interesting is this is looking at the day the market peaks, what percentage of the market was already in a bear market, meaning it was down 20% or more. What we found was 22% of stocks, nearly one-fifth of the entire market, was already in a bear market before the market even peaked. And of those that were down 30% or more, 11% of the market. And some questions that people have is if we are saying that being in passively managed investments like ETFs are dangerous and that's where the herd is going, well, then why do we have them for our clients? Here's the reason. What is your luck of picking a winning stock near a market top? Very low. When you hide in the index, you typically have better returns than being in individual stocks near a market top. And what I want to show you is that market tops are a process, because fewer and fewer stocks are following the overall index up. And it's kind of like the analogy of looking at the four seasons. And what I want to show you is that as you get near a market top, kind of like fall gives you an indication that you're approaching winter when you start to see the leaves change color, the momentum of the market begins to slow. You're not participating as fast. You're not appreciating. And as you go from fall to winter, one by one, leaves start falling off a tree. Think of the tree as the index, the Dow or the S&P 500. Think of the individual leaves as individual stocks within that index. Pretty soon, when you start looking at it, at the tree, when more leaves have fallen off, oh my gosh, I'm in winter. Oh my gosh, I'm in a bear market. And that's how bear markets begin. It's a slow process as fewer and fewer stocks are following the index. And what I want to show you this is, let me walk you through this, and this is what a market top looks like. I'm looking at the New York Stock Exchange in this top panel, and this is the 2000 market top. What I'm looking at in these green and red lines is the percentage of stocks in the New York Stock Exchange, thousands of stocks. What percentage of those were making a new high or a new low? Here's 2000. If you didn't own a technology stock, more than likely your portfolio was not going up. Look at 1998 with the long-term capital management crisis. You had 35% of stocks were hitting new lows. But what I want to show you is here's 1997. And at that point, we had about 20% of the market would hit a new high. And near a market top, there's fewer and fewer stocks making new highs. At the same time, there's more and more stocks making new lows. Notice from 2000 to 2002, we were in a bear market. Knowing that, you would expect more stocks are going down than going up. And that's exactly what we saw. At each of these mini bear market lows, we saw 25 to 30% of stocks also making new lows. What happened in 2003? You started to see leaves coming back on the tree. Look at new highs. New highs were expanding. New lows were contracting. You were starting to see spring coming in the market. 2007 market top process, very, very similar. Here's 2007. From 2006 up to that point, new highs, the green line, was exceeding new lows. We had more stocks participating than those that were falling behind. Notice the first warning shot was in July of 2007. I don't know if you remember, but we had a pretty significant correction in the market. Look at new lows spiked to 20%. Notice that new lows dominated and new highs began to evaporate. But notice the market kept going up. Why? The mega cap stocks, the Walmarts, the Googles, the Pricelines. The S&P, the Dow is a price-weighted index, but the S&P and others are market cap-weighted. The bigger you are, the more influence you have. And most people, they gravitate towards those big companies with big balance sheets. And that's why you see the market keep going up, even though most stocks are going down. Here was the March 2009 lows. Notice in the prior year, you saw fewer and fewer stocks hitting new lows. And what was telling you was that the market was getting ready to turn. And notice in 2009, new highs dominated. You almost didn't see any new lows. That was a transition. And as a firm, what we look at is for this. We're looking for the four seasons. Are leaves coming on the tree or coming off of the tree? Here is the current market. There's a lot of people who believe 2015 was the bull market top. As a firm, we didn't, because we don't just look at technicals, we look at fundamentals, we look at the economy. And based on what we saw in the economy, believe it or not, the best for the U.S. economy was in 2015, in terms of growth rates. I think we were averaging almost 300,000 new jobs every single month. There was too much momentum in the economy. This was more of a market-driven, financial market-driven event, not an economic event. And again, as I mentioned, most bear markets occur in the context of a recession. But notice you did see an expansion in new lows. And so understandably, there's a lot of people who were fearful in 2014 and 15. But notice new lows evaporated. And now, what do we see right now? We see that new highs are exceeding new lows. When are we going to get concerned and get more and know when it's time to sell? When we start seeing something like this. And we start seeing the economy slow down. That, as a firm, tells us we need to start dialing down our risk. And again, when do we stop dancing, start running? We've developed our own recession model. And if you remember last year, I was saying that there could be a good chance that we'd be in recession by late this year. When I gave that talk last year, that's where our recession model was, right at the threshold of 20%. Outside of the 87, every time we've exceeded that, we've been in a recession. If we would have waited a month, I probably wouldn't have made that call because our recession model went straight down to almost zero. Where are we right now? We're back up to the low 20s. So in our opinion, we are in the latter innings, and there's a greater risk of a recession on the horizon than where we were a few months ago. And another famous Warren Buffett quote, it's only when the tide goes out do you see who's been swimming naked. And the idea is, you don't know who's leveraged. You don't know which of your neighbors is the one the last cycle had three or four different investment homes, or how many people were buying stocks on margin in 2000. It's only when the tide goes out, when interest rates go up, when liquidity starts to come out of the economy, out of the financial markets, you see who are those that are leveraged. And what I'm looking in red is a Bloomberg Financial Stress Index. And what it's looking at is the health of all of our credit markets, looking at the money market, commercial paper, the bond market, the currency markets. And it's looking at how much stress is in the system. And in red are recessions. And this goes back to 1990 to the present. And you can see this little correction right here, that was long-term capital management. You remember when I showed you the 2000 market top? Outside of the technology sector, most stocks actually were not doing very well. Notice that financial conditions were showing a lot of stress. And then in 2002, financial stress began to ease. And in 2003, it turned positive and we were in a new bull market. Look what happened in 2007. Look at financial stress and look at the stock market. If you watch the credit markets, what banks were doing, what currency traders were doing, they were telling you everything was not right and you should start heading towards the exits. What is it saying right now? We are at the lowest level of stress in the entire expansion. As of right now, that is why you're not seeing your accounts and we have huge amounts of cash and why we're still invested. We're not seeing the signs of heading towards the exits yet. Some of your conclusions. What I presented to you was that value matters. When you buy matters, when you sell matters. And currently right now, the valuations for the stock market, the bond market, almost any market is very expensive. Given where valuations are, we should expect a very dismal picture. And again, that is for the buy and hold investor. If you just put your money in the market, whether it's the bond market or if it's in the equity market, you should expect low returns on your portfolio if you're buy and hold. And that is why we are arguing the case for active management of looking for the signals when to get out and when things start to improve to get in to beat the market and beat those dismal returns. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris Poplava. Coming up next at the Financial Sense Investment Strategy Conference, we'll hear more from Jim Poplava, president of Financial Sense Wealth Management.